Right. So many of you have been asking for a deep dive into how geography and environment can really shape how a species evolves.
Definitely a hot topic.
Yeah. And it's perfect timing because we have some really cool research on butterflies.
It's a good one.
Yeah. It's a 2022 paper by Pollack and their team. And they used, get this, DNA analysis.
Wow.
To study butterfly populations.
That's amazing.
I know. Mainly European butterflies. But yeah. They did have a little side trip to Morocco for one species.
Oh, yeah. They looked at three specific species.
Oh. So not just any butterfly will do.
Not for this study. Nope. We're talking Spiraea aglaja, Fabriciana adipe, and then Fabriciana niobe.
Whoa, those are some names.
They are, right?
But are they all related somehow? Because that'd be a lot to keep track of if they weren't.
Oh, they are. They're all in the same family group.
Right.
The Arginini tribe. Think of them like cousins.
Okay.
All sharing those classic fritillary wing patterns.
Fritillary, so like that checkered look.
Yeah, exactly.
So they might look alike, but do they act alike? Is that what they were looking at?
That's the cool part, right? They have some pretty big differences, especially in where they like to live and what kind of habitat they prefer.
Picky butterflies?
Some are, yeah. Like Spiraea aglaja, that first one. That one's a real traveler.
Get out of town.
I'm serious. You can find it all the way from North Africa to Southeast Asia, even up in Scandinavia.
Wait, that's one well-traveled butterfly.
Seriously. And then Fabriciana adip is more of a homebody.
Okay.
Sticking to woodlands. Doesn't like it too cold.
Gotcha.
And then you've got Fabriciana niobe. This one wants it dry and warm.
So we've got like one generalist, two specialists. Is that how to think about it?
Yeah. And that was kind of the point. Like, how does that lifestyle, being a generalist or specialist, affect their evolution?
That's a great question.
Right. Can the generalist handle more change? What about if you're picky, does that make it harder to adapt?
Right, right. And I'm also thinking, doesn't how far they can fly play a role too? Like, if a butterfly can go the distance, you can get over a mountain range easier,
right?
Or cross a big body of water.
You're totally on the right track. Dispersal, we call it. It's huge EE in evolution.
Makes sense.
If you can easily spread out, you get to mix your genes up more.
Right.
More opportunities, more diversity, maybe makes you tougher overall.
So that's what they were trying to figure out with the DNA. Like, did they find anything surprising in those butterfly genes?
Oh, they did. They found these distinct genetic clusters.
Ooh, what's that mean?
Like, imagine a map of Europe, right? And different zones light up.
Yeah, I'm picturing it.
Three main clusters they found, one in Iberia, one in the southern Balkans, then one covering basically the rest of Europe.
So like three distinct butterfly groups.
Pretty much. And of course, S. aglaja, our world traveler, had a separate cluster down in Morocco.
Oh, right, the jet setter. But why would they cluster like that? Did something happen in those regions?
Think back to the Ice Age.
Bruh.
I know, right?
Yeah.
But during those glacial periods, a lot of species got squeezed into these warmer pockets.
Like little safe zones.
Exactly. Refugia, we call them.
Fancy.
So they're stuck in these refugia, generation after generation, adapting to those conditions.
Ah, so their DNA today is like a snapshot of that Ice Age isolation.
You got it. Yeah. We always think of Iberia as the refuge, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But this study showing the Balkans were a big deal, too. Yeah,
cool. And there's this other detail that caught my eye. They mentioned that the mountains in Iberia might split up S. aglaja even further.
Interesting.
But F. adip wasn't as affected.
Hmm. Makes you think.
It does. Like, maybe because F. adip can fly further, those mountains weren't such a big deal.
Exactly what I was thinking. Like, they stayed connected while S. aglaja got kind of fragmented.
So being able to fly long distances is like an evolutionary advantage.
Who could say that? Yeah. Like a superpower when those barriers pop up.
Makes you wonder about other species too, right?
Definitely. And then you've got the F. adip in Catalonia.
Oh, okay.
They showed up as this genetic mix right at the boundary of two clusters.
Ooh, a mixed breed.
We call it a contact zone. Super interesting.
What happens there? Do they, like, fight for territory?
More like it's where different lineages meet up.
Mm.
It's like evolution in action, you know. Could even be a new species forming.
Well, hold on. Are we seeing the birth of a new butterfly?
Potentially. There's been debate about whether the Catalan F. adip is a subspecies.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Because they look different.
Yeah, they have some distinct traits, but this study suggests, based on the DNA, they're still the same species.
Huh. So looks can be deceiving.
Tell me about it. Now, F. niobe, ready for a twist.
Always.
Their biggest DNA differences weren't in Iberia.
Wait, seriously? I thought that was DAE refuge.
I know, right? But it was in the Balkans that F. niobe showed the most divergence. That's what we call it.
Divergence, meaning like their DNA is more unique there.
Exactly. So it's not just where the refuge is, but how long they were isolated.
Oh, so maybe the Balkans were cut off for longer for F. niobe?
That's one possibility, yeah.
So time matters just as much as location.
Big time. Evolution doesn't happen overnight, remember.
True. Okay, so we've got history, we've got geography, all playing out in these butterfly genes, but I have a feeling there's more to the story, right?
You know, there's a whole other layer to this.
Oh.
They went deeper, looking at a specific gene called COI.
Okay. Another fancy name.
It's part of the mitochondrial DNA.
Mitochondrial, that's the...
The powerhouse of the cell.
Right. My bio teacher would be proud.
And the cool thing about mitochondrial DNA is it's only passed down through the mother.
Whoa. So it's like a family tree, but just the moms.
You got it. Maternal lineage tracker.
So... By looking at COI, they can trace back the moms of all these butterflies.
Yep. And what they found, oh boy, fascinating stuff.
Come on, I'm hooked. What they find?
Well, for F. adip and F. niobe, the COI matched their regular DNA.
Okay, so that confirms the clusters and all that.
Exactly. But for S. aglaja, totally different story.
Hold up, different story how?
Yeah.
You're freaking me out.
Their mitochondrial DNA, it was telling a different evolutionary tale than their nuclear DNA.
Wait, back up. How can one butterfly have two different stories in its DNA? Am I missing something?
Think about it. Nuclear DNA comes from both parents, right?
Right.
Mitochondrial is just from mom. So picture this. What if the females are the ones moving around more?
Okay.
Their mitochondrial DNA, they're spreading it far and wide, more than the nuclear DNA, which stays kind of local.
So it's the adventurous females who are shaping the species' future.
Bingo. And there's actually other research on S. aglaja showing that females do fly further than the males.
No way. So the guys stay home, the girls go exploring, and it's written in their DNA.
That's evolution, baby. We call it mitonuclear discordance. Catchy, right?
Mitonuclear discordance. All right, I'll try to remember that.
But yeah, it shows you how even individual behavior, like how far the females fly, can impact the whole species.
That is wild. So back to our genetic map. They mentioned a sample from the Carpathian Mountains. That was weird.
Ah, you noticed that.
Yeah, it stood out. What was up with that?
So that was an S. aglaja sample, and its COI was completely different from all the others.
A rogue butterfly.
Kind of. It suggests there might be a hidden pocket of genetic diversity there, like a tiny refuge we didn't even know about.
Whoa, really? Just from one butterfly?
One sample, yeah. We call them micro-refugia.
Micro-refugia. Gotta love these science words.
Right, but it shows you even these tiny pockets of habitat can be super important.
Like they make a big difference in the long run.
Huge. This whole study is about that. It's not just the big picture.
Uh-huh.
It's the small stuff too, those micro-refugia, even how individual butterflies act.
And it all adds up to how a species evolves over time.
You got it. It's this intricate web of connections, fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it is. We've talked about history, geography, even these tiny refuges, but there's got to be more, right? Like, doesn't the actual environment play a role too?
You bet. Things like temperature, rainfall, all that good stuff, that's up next.
I'm ready. Let's dive in. So we've talked about history and geography shaping how these butterflies evolved, but I'm guessing the environment plays a big role too, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Temperature, rainfall, all of that.
Makes a huge difference, especially for butterflies, right? Their lives are so tied to plants and all.
You're exactly right. And this study, they really dug into that.
Oh, cool.
Like how different environmental factors actually correlated with those genetic patterns.
So they were looking for links. Like, does this environmental thing affect that gene?
That's it. They looked at everything. I mean, temperature, sunlight, even wind speed.
Wow. That's a lot of data.
Yeah, it is.
But were there any, like, common threads? Anything that seemed important for all the butterfly species?
Yeah, there were a couple that really stood out.
Okay, what were they?
Solar radiation and precipitation. Makes sense, right?
Yeah, sunlight and water. That's like plant basics.
It is. And plants are the foundation of a butterfly's world, right?
Yeah, caterpillars need them to eat, and then the adults need nectar from flowers.
Exactly. So the environment shapes their food, which could then shape them over time.
It's all connected.
Totally. But it gets even cooler. Each species also had its own unique, we call it an environmental fingerprint.
Ooh, a fingerprint. Like, what does that mean?
It means those subtle differences in their lifestyle, they really matter.
Okay, so they're all affected by the big stuff, like sun and rain.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's these smaller scale differences too, based on how each species lives.
Exactly. So like for Speyeria aglaja, our world traveler, remember?
Yeah, the one that goes everywhere.
For that one, latitude, temperature, and precipitation, those were the biggies.
Okay, and why latitude?
Well, think about it. The further north or south you go, the more the climate changes. Right.
Right.
So that makes sense. And then remember those Moroccan S. aglaja?
Yeah, the ones with their own little cluster.
Their genetic data was really distinct.
Hmm, makes sense.
Probably reflecting how different Morocco's climate is compared to Europe.
Right, it's like on the edge of the Sahara Desert, that's going to be pretty different.
Totally. Now, for Fabriciana Adip, our woodland specialist, remember?
Yeah, the picky one.
Altitude was a big one for them, along with temperature, precipitation, even wind speed.
Oh, altitude.
Yeah.
Why would that matter for a butterfly?
Well, think about how conditions change as you go up a mountain.
It gets colder.
That's one thing. But wind speed changes too.
Oh, wow.
All that can affect their flight, finding food, even mating, you know?
Makes sense. So basically, their preference for woodlands, which are often at different altitudes, that shows up in their genes.
You got it. And you know what's even weirder? When they looked at just the Iberian F. adip,
okay,
took them out of the analysis,
huh,
solar radiation and wind speed, those became even stronger influences.
So even within one species, different populations can experience different things.
Totally. And those differences shape how they evolve. It's crazy, right?
It is. Okay, so what about the last one, Fabriciana Niobe? What were their big environmental factors?
That one, it was latitude again, solar radiation, and precipitation.
Okay, so back to the basics that control plant growth.
Yep. Makes you realize it all comes back to those fundamental things, doesn't it?
It does. But what's the takeaway from all this analysis? Like, what does it tell us about how these butterflies adapted?
Well, one thing that's really interesting, it suggests that being a specialist, like F. adip or F. niobe, might make you more vulnerable.
Vulnerable, like to change.
Yeah, to environmental shifts, you know. If your preferred habitat changes and you can't move easily, you're in trouble.
Right, because you're specialized for that specific spot.
Exactly. They're adapted to a very narrow set of conditions. If those change too fast, they might not be able to keep up.
So this brings us back to dispersal, right? Like we were talking about before.
It all connects. If you can move to new areas, you have more options, you know?
Right, even if your old home isn't so good anymore.
Exactly. So being a generalist or being really good at moving around, that could be a big advantage these days.
Like with climate change and all.
Exactly. This whole study really shows how history, ecology, even how individual butterflies act, it's all intertwined.
Yeah, and it all shapes how the species evolves.
Yeah.
It's not just survival of the fittest, right? It's way more complicated.
It is. It's this dance between genes and the environment.
And it's happening all the time.
Constantly, yeah. And that's what makes studying evolution so cool, you know?
Yeah, it is.
Like, we can use things like landscape genetics, phylogeography, all these tools to start untangling those connections.
It's like detective work, but for evolution.
Totally. But we've talked about all the science stuff, history, DNA, these environmental pressures. What does it all mean? Why should anyone care about these butterflies?
That's a good question. Yeah, what's the takeaway?
Well, it's not just about butterflies, you know? It's about understanding the forces that shape life on Earth.
Right, the big picture.
Exactly. And think about it. If we can figure out how these butterflies adapted to past changes, like ice ages, climate shifts, all of that, could we use that knowledge to predict how other species, even us, will respond to what's happening now?
Whoa. Are we saying we can learn about our own future by studying butterflies?
It's not that simple, of course. But by studying how other species have adapted, we can gain insights into evolution itself, into resilience, you know?
Right, like what makes some species more vulnerable and others tougher.
Exactly. So these butterflies are like little windows into the past, showing us how life coped with change over millions of years.
That's awesome. But can we actually do anything with that knowledge, like beyond just understanding it?
That's a great question, and that's what we're going to talk about next.
Okay, I'm ready for part three. Okay, so we've talked about how these butterflies adapted, you know, way back in the day. But what about now? Can we use what we've learned to actually help them keep adapting as things change?
That's a really big question right now. You know, a lot of scientists are trying to figure that out.
Yeah, climate change is already happening. It's affecting everything.
It is, yeah.
So what are we doing about it? Like, what are some of the ideas people are considering for these butterflies?
Well, one idea that's out there is to create, like, corridors of habitat.
Corridors? like pathways.
Yeah, think of it like linking up those fragmented populations.
Oh, right. We were talking about how important dispersal is.
Exactly. So if we create these corridors, even as the climate shifts, those butterflies can still move around, mix their genes.
So instead of just protecting where they live now, we'd be helping them move to new areas as things change.
That's the idea, yeah. It's called assisted migration, sometimes managed relocation.
Sounds kind of intense. Like, are we playing God a little here?
Well, some people might say that, but there are risks for sure.
Kind of risks.
You have to be super careful about introducing a species somewhere new, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to create an invasive species problem. That'd be even worse.
Right. So it's like a delicate balance.
It is, definitely. But the point is, this research is making us think about conservation differently.
Differently how?
It's not just about protecting what we have right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's about helping species adapt, being proactive.
So we're shifting from defense to offense, kind of.
I like that analogy. Okay. Like, we're not just trying to hold back the tide. We're learning how to ride the waves.
Exactly. That's a way better way to put it.
Yeah, we got to be thinking ahead, anticipating the changes, and our conservation efforts need to be more, like, dynamic.
They got to keep up.
Exactly.
I
think that's what these butterflies are teaching us.
Yeah, they've shown us a lot.
They have. They've taken us on this crazy journey from glacial refugia to the power of female dispersal.
And their DNA is like a history book.
It is, telling us how they responded to all these past challenges, and that's got lessons for us.
So final question. What's the take-home message for our listeners? Like, what should they remember from all this?
I think the big thing is we got to approach conservation with, like, a sense of wonder.
Wonder.
Curiosity and, you know, and a willingness to learn from the past. These butterflies, they've shown us that even the smallest creatures, they can teach us amazing things about resilience, about adaptation.
And hopefully that'll help us shape a future where everyone can thrive.
That's the goal. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
It's been a wild ride. We've had ice ages, DNA detective work, even some rogue butterflies.
And a whole lot of evolution.
We'll be back next time with another fascinating topic. Until then, keep exploring, keep wondering, and we'll see you soon.